Well, good evening, and welcome to our fourth class. This is our mind-body class, maybe my favorite class, either this one or the last two classes. And I think this one is super exciting because it takes this topic, the mind-body connection, that's really out there in the popular media, and everyone's heard about it, and some people think it's total hooey, and some people think it's really, really interesting, and there are other people who really make their lives about it. And what I try to do with this is present it in a really grounded and practical light where you can take these concepts and on the one level, and this is actually the less important level, on the one level there's an action step based on tonight's concepts. And there's some things to think about doing in your life. But more importantly, there's a shift in thinking that occurs. And it's at this point in the course that I sort of like to talk about what I see as the formula for success in transforming your body, but I also think it's a formula for success in life. And I guess what most people, the formula for success in most people's minds is sort of like maybe take action, get results, and then a little more enlightened formula is plan, then take action, then get results. And probably the enlightened formula that most of us run by most of the time is accumulate knowledge, and then plan, and then take action and get results. And I think that's why most people take something like a health and wellness course, a nutrition course, or a breakthrough results course. The idea is let me accumulate knowledge, and then let this course, let this structure help me plan. And then, of course, I understand that I'm going to have to take actions and get results. Well, there's a deeper dimension that underlies all of that, which is, for lack of a better term, it's the perspective that you approach the entire situation from. What's your perspective going in? And this is something we don't often consider. And the reason we don't often consider our perspective when we're going into any situation is that we tend to assume subconsciously that we know what we want, we know what our goals are, and that we have a reasonable idea of how to achieve those goals. So let's take it outside the context of health. Let's say that my goal is to do something in my community. Let's say I want to, build a baseball park for the local kids. Well, the minute you think of it and you feel a little inspired, you feel, oh, great, well, of course I know what my goal is. My goal is to build a baseball park for the little kids. And then you think, I should probably learn a little bit about baseball parks, and you educate yourself, and you meet the right people, and you go take the right actions. You write a business proposal, and you have fundraising, and you study public speaking, and you go talk before the local committee. And if you get all those actions right and you kind of build the right relationships, maybe you get that baseball park built. Well, the broader perspective would say you have this intention to build a baseball park so that kids can play baseball. But ultimately, what is it that you're really trying to achieve here? And you might talk about good intentions and doing good. And the deeper perspective would say, really what you want to do is impact these children's lives in a positive way. You want to set them up for greater success in life. You want to give them a greater sense of self-worth and of self-esteem. You want to bring them together and you want to form community. There are deeper goals here. And when you get present to those deeper goals, there are all sorts of new considerations that come in. It might change the location that you choose. You may choose to add structures to your baseball stadium, like maybe a common picnic area or maybe some sort of space where adults can meet and congregate. And all of a sudden it becomes a deeper vision. And you also may choose from the very outset to build this thing in a way that integrates it into the community in a really positive and uplifting fashion. For instance, when kids play sports and it's co-ed, they're less competitive. I'm just making this stuff up. So maybe you make it go co-ed. But what I'm saying is that you question in a more rigorous fashion what you're really trying to get out of this endeavor. Well, now let's come back to fitness, health and fitness. Being someone in the health and fitness industry, my job on a superficial level as a business person is to get people to take health and fitness classes and to sign up for counseling and to consume health and fitness products. And then at a slightly deeper level, my job is to really deliver results. I don't really see my work in that way at all. I look at it more like, what is everything that I can really deliver to people using almost health and fitness as the excuse? Using an interest in nutrition as an excuse, using an interest in weight loss as an excuse, using an interest in exercise and getting in better shape as an excuse. So I know full well that when people come for a class of mine or when they come to meet with me one-on-one, they have a very clear goal in mind. There's some sort of problem that they want a solution to, or there's some sort of place they think they can get to, it'll be really fun, and there's not a problem now. So it's either I'm overweight and I don't want to be overweight, or I have this chronic condition and I don't want to have this chronic condition, or I don't like the way I feel or look, and I want to look or feel better. That's the problem side. On the positive side, maybe, and this is actually far more rare, it's, you know, I'm feeling good, I'm feeling pretty happy, but there's something just, you know, really fun and extraordinary that I want to do. I want to be a great gymnast, or I want to be a better basketball player, or I want to, you know, be able to dance with more energy. Well, all that is great as far as it goes. But that is the surface level of what health and fitness can deliver. It is the superficial surface level. And even getting to those goals that people set, the real truth is that it's usually not as satisfying as people expect. This is true in health and fitness, and it's actually true in every sphere of life. And many, many scientific studies have been done to confirm this. People who are overweight, who are unhappy and lose a great deal of weight, frequently they're not that much happier when they've lost the weight. And that's actually part of the reason that people tend to put weight back on. There's a week of happiness. Maybe, you know, the scale drops and you think, yes, I'm thinner, and you put on a new outfit and you feel better for a day or two and it goes away. Something else enters your life. You know, you get stressed about work or you have a negative interaction with someone or, God forbid, something with a relationship. Like, you're really excited to get in better shape to start dating and then that doesn't go well. And all of a sudden you're right back where you started and the result that you've achieved doesn't matter. This is famously true with money. It's very rare that you would find a person who doesn't believe that having more money would make them happier. It's extensively studied, not the case at all. Lottery winners, on average, tend to be slightly less happy a year after winning the lottery. And interestingly, the two most unhappy segments of our culture are the very rich and the very poor. The upper middle class are the happiest. So it's interesting. If you're dealing with real privation, yeah, money can make a difference. But as you accumulate more and more and more, it doesn't make people happy. And yet most of us believe that it would. So sometimes, in the face of this message, the reaction can sort of be dismal. If getting in better shape won't make me happy, why on earth am I doing this? And are you telling me that getting past my diabetes or my depression won't make me happy? No, I'm not saying that at all. The resolution of physical conditions contributes tremendously to quality of life. And to some extent, getting in shape can make a difference too. But it is superficial. It's not profound. And there is something really profound that can come out of this commitment, a deeper, call it transformation, a deeper transition. And that's what real well-being is. Well-being is when your physical body works, but you really just don't think about it. Your physical body really isn't a factor to you. It's when you're in a state of emotional alignment where you live your life with a level of ease and a level of vitality and inner peace and enthusiasm and energy. That's well-being. Well-being is a state of being, and it includes, or rather it actually brings about, the positive impact on health that many people are searching for at a certain level. So as a practitioner, my goal with everyone I work with is well-being. It's fine for people to lose 40 pounds. It's fine for people to, you know, change symptoms. That's wonderful. It's great. But it only truly makes a difference when there's a deeper transformation, a well-being transformation. So tonight's class is about well-being. And I want to explore well-being more deeply. And we're going to look at this idea of well-being in the mind-body perspective. We're going to look through two lenses. First, we're going to look through what you might call the scientific lens or the Western lens. And then we're going to look through a deeper lens. You could call it a philosophic lens or a psychological lens or even a spiritual lens. So with that in mind, we're going to look through two lenses. I'm going to dive into what you could call the science of mind-body, and we're going to talk a little bit about neurology and brain chemistry and all that fun stuff, because I think it's really important to talk about this stuff, because all of us have heard about it in the media, most of us believe in it, and if we don't put this discussion in that context, it's going to seem a little bit airy-fairy. So if you go back 50, 60 years, and you talk to scientists, and you say something about the mind changing the body, you're a crazy person. And even in the 70s and the 80s, the idea that the mind changed the body was seen as pretty ridiculous. There wasn't thought to be a mind-body connection. It was believed, especially in the 80s and into the early 90s, that the body could change the mind. So as we began to discover neurochemistry, as we started to look at chemicals like serotonin and dopamine and norepinephrine, and we realized, my God, there are these chemicals that affect mood. we notice that when people have low levels of serotonin, they feel depressed. When they have low levels of dopamine, they don't have energy. They're not motivated. And when these levels increase, they feel better. This created a revolution. And it explained why drugs work. It explained why someone could, you know, snort white powder in the form of cocaine and feel this surge of energy and confidence and, ah, I can take on the world, and then go back to being depressed 6 hours later. It explained why ecstasy works. You take a pill and all of a sudden you love people and you're totally happy, and then it wears off and you feel miserable. And the reason that those drugs work is that they artificially elevate the levels of these chemicals in the brain, chemicals like serotonin and dopamine and epinephrine. So really, really fascinating. You've got chemistry in your brain, and the levels of those chemicals in your brain oscillate, and when they're in the right range, you feel wonderful. When they're not in the right range, you feel awful. And when people got that, of course, medicine being medicine, the first reaction was, let's develop drugs that will affect these chemicals, drugs that don't work like cocaine and get you high and then cause you to crash, drugs that people can take every day that will actually treat depression and anxiety and all sorts of conditions. And these are what are called neuroleptic drugs, and we now have an arsenal of these in our culture. They're very widely prescribed. Wellbutrin, Effexor, Prozac, they're all over the place. And they've had a very mixed history. You know, there are a few people who I feel like they've really been helped by them, but most people don't really like the way they feel on them, and they seem to create suicide, and some people get more depressed, and it's sort of been this dismal and confusing journey in exploring, trying to use drug effects to modulate human mood. But one thing that seems certain was that this chemistry is impacting mood, and so we kind of developed this philosophy that mood is mostly a body thing. There's not really a mind-body connection, there's a body-mind connection. So goes the body, so goes the mind. And you could look for less elaborate examples of this than drug use or the fact that we can design chemicals that affect how we feel. When you don't get a good night's sleep, it affects your mood. You don't sleep deeply. You know that diet affects your mood, and we've certainly talked about that. If you don't eat for a long time, you can get very cranky, and you can feel really down and really low. And if you eat the wrong kinds of foods, if you eat really sugary foods, really floury foods, they tend to give you a little rush and make you feel a little better for a little while, and then there's a crash, and you feel worse because those foods act like drugs on the brain. They actually act a little bit like the drug ecstasy. Sugary and floury foods act a little bit like ecstasy on the brain. So there seem to be all these body things that we can do that involve sleep and that involve nutrition. Exercise is the same. We know that when you exercise, you get boosts of certain chemicals, and exercise works like antidepressants. It actually works far better than antidepressants, and exercise can make you feel better. So there seems like there's this body-brain, body-mind connection. And there's a level of reality at which this is true. The idea of a mind-body connection, that the mind can impact the body, was a little slower in coming. But with the discovery of all these neurochemicals, scientists started to notice something interesting. There are receptors for these neurochemicals, these chemicals of emotion, on cells in the body. So what a receptor is a receptor is a structure that lets a chemical tell a cell what to do. And if you don't have receptors, chemicals can't do anything. So, for instance, serotonin is a chemical, and in the brain, when serotonin levels are appropriate, you get that kind of happy well-being feeling. Well, that couldn't happen without serotonin receptors. Interestingly, there are serotonin receptors on your heart. There are also serotonin receptors on your white blood cells. And the deeper scientists look, they found receptors for almost every neurochemical on almost every tissue. Your white blood cells, your immune system, your heart, your liver, stuff all throughout your body is listening to and responding to the chemistry of emotion. Fascinating. So if you take the next step with me, and it's a step that most scientists would be cynical about, but I don't think you can possibly argue with it. It makes perfect sense. Obviously, the way that we think affects our emotions, the way that you think about yourself and your life. Simple as this. Take someone and put them in the presence of a really positive person who encourages them and validates them and says all sorts of wonderful things, and let that person condition their sense of self-worth, and that you'll feel good. On the flip side, take a person, put them in the presence of someone who undermines them and demeans them and makes them feel awful about themselves, and that person will probably feel bad. You'd feel bad if you were in their situation. Well, all that's going on here is thought. You listen to another person say, you know, you're fantastic and you're always there for me when I need you, and I just think you're such a deeply good human being and I value you and you're a contribution, and there's a positive emotional reaction as long as you believe them and you respect them. On the flip side, someone is vicious and attacks you, there's a negative emotional reaction. All that's happened is thinking. I mean, you just heard a bunch of words come out of that person's mouth. If you didn't speak the language they were speaking, it wouldn't have affected your emotions. Maybe you'd have seen their facial expressions. The important thing is their words and their facial expressions get translated into thoughts. And then you think those thoughts. And interestingly, you can go away from that person, and 2 hours later, based on the interaction, you're still feeling the emotion. You can feel a glow after a positive human interaction. You can feel awful after a negative human interaction. Well, all this is just thought. Interestingly, your neurochemistry is dancing in response. When you've had the interaction that leaves you feeling confident and happy and inspired and empowered and engaged, those happy neurochemicals like serotonin, dopamine, they're doing their happy dance in the brain. The levels and the rhythms with which they're being released from your brain cells are consistent with a feeling of confidence and joy. On the other hand, when you've been undermined, there's a completely different neurochemical profile. So your thoughts are changing in response to what you're hearing in the world, and then your neurochemistry is changing and your emotions are changing. Well, if the chemistry is changing in the brain, it's not only changing in the brain. The body is also changing because the brain communicates with the body. So when you have thoughts that make you stressed, for instance, your boss comes and says, you know, this report was terrible, and if you give me another report like this, you feel stress. Well, it's all thought. It's all mental. I mean, there's nothing going on here other than your perception of reality, other than the way that you're thinking. It alters your brain chemistry. What happens to your body? Your heart rate increases. You get a little bit jittery. Well, that's your brain talking to your body and changing your chemistry in your body. Amazing. So that is the mind-body connection. Every time that we as human beings react to the way that we're thinking about the world, we're experiencing the completely unequivocal, impossible to argue with mind-body connection. And it's being mediated through chemistry. And in fact, we can track this chemistry. And it's so bizarre that there's still so much skepticism when the word mind-body connection is used, because no one denies that stress is bad for the body. No one denies that stress dramatically increases the likelihood of heart disease. Everyone admits the connection between stress and various cancer and other illnesses, stress and diabetes. Well, stress is so clearly a mental thing. It's a thought thing. There's nothing to stress other than thought, unless you're under an acute physical stress, which is different. But what we call stress, it's a mind thing. And we all get that it's affecting the body. And you can take the most skeptical person in the Western world, and then frequently this is like, you know, people involved in institutions tend to be very skeptical about this stuff, and say to them, mind-body connection, what a bunch of junk. But then say to them, does stress affect you? Well, yeah, I have so much stress, and stress affects me tremendously. It affects my heart rate and my blood pressure. Mind-body connection, no-brainer. The reason people react negatively when you talk about the mind-body connection is that for the most part, when it's brought up, the idea is that you can use it in some positive way. Oh, you should use the mind-body connection. And that's what mind-body health is about, or mind-body well-being. It's about using this mind-body connection to make your body healthier. And when you start talking about that, you start to sound like a quack, or you start to sound like, you know, you're out there. And most people in our culture believe that the prescription drug is real, and the idea that you can do something mental to make yourself healthier physical is probably a bunch of crap. And that perspective, interestingly enough, creates that reality. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, about what, the why of this later. The less you believe in this stuff, the less well it works. It's actually fascinating. But if you buy the negative mind-body connection, if you buy that stress and negative thinking can negatively impact your body, why is it difficult to accept that positive thinking and the positive emotional states that are involved in positive thinking can positively affect the body? The reason this idea is difficult for us to accept is that there's been very little consistent and uniform success in creating positive thinking. It's very difficult to get people to consciously think in a way that makes them feel better emotionally. And it's an amazing thing that this is so challenging. And it raises fascinating questions about our free will. Mostly our thoughts run themselves. And as our thoughts tend towards the negative, we experience the negative consequences. And we're aware of that. And for most people, stress is a much greater reality than joy. It's a sad fact of current human existence. And so more people are aware of the negative impact of stress on the body than they are of the positive impact, because most people don't really experience a whole lot of consistent positive thinking and consistent positive emotion. And until you learn how to do it, you can't just will it. And that's where the skepticism comes in. But what if you could train yourself to actually think in a way that made you feel better emotionally. Really feel better emotionally. We're not talking about affirmations or something like that. You know, I think everyone kind of pictures this self-help guru taking money from desperate people, telling them to look in the mirror and repeat, you know, I believe I'm thin, or I believe I'm beautiful, or I believe I love myself, and meanwhile they feel like crap. We're talking about an actual felt response here. Training yourself to unequivocally sense an emotional shift in the direction of peace, in the direction of joy, in the direction of love, in the direction of something that feels good. If you can do that, you're going to shift your chemistry, and your chemistry is going to change your body. Of course, more importantly, you'll feel good. I think that's a better prize than improving your body. Feeling good is wonderful. But it'll change your body. It absolutely will. So go emotions, so goes the body. That's the complexity of the mind-body connection. It really is that simple. So go emotions, so go the body. When we focus on thought, things get confusing because you can try to tell yourself to think stuff on the surface of your mind, but you don't really think it. You don't really think it. You don't really believe it. You can kind of tell yourself anything on the surface of your mind, but you know whether you really believe it or not. And that's the difference between true confidence and lack of true confidence. Fascinating. Look at a person that has true confidence. You see they're inspired. They take powerful actions. And you sort of intellectually get that they're no different from you. But if you don't have confidence in a given sphere, like I don't have confidence in the sphere of dancing, I can't just tell myself that I have confidence in the sphere of dancing. I can say, I'm a good dancer, but I don't really believe it. I can even say, I'm going to become a good dancer. All I have to do is work hard. I don't really believe it. So can I work with that belief? Well, in a nutshell, the answer is yes. Before we dive into how you do this, and what I would really call the mental-emotional side of this, I want to talk about the placebo effect, because it really kind of drives home this point. So the placebo effect, if you haven't heard of it, is a phenomenon from research science. And what placebos are is they're fake drugs that people are given as part of scientific studies to compare the efficacy of a real drug to the fake drug. So, for instance, let's say we are coming up with a drug that we're proposing to treat headaches. Well, we have to provide evidence to the government to be able to sell that drug to people and say that it prevents headaches. You can't just give 600 people the drug and then ask them if their headache got better and do some blood tests and see that the headache got better. And the reason you can't is because every scientist knows that if you take 600 people who have headaches and you give them a sugar pill, you give them a fake drug, and you tell them that it's Tylenol, their headaches will get better very, very consistently. And this has been observed in pretty much every research study that's ever been done in the history of the world. And as a result of this, government regulations from the FDA require you, whenever you test the efficacy of a drug, to test it against a fake drug or a placebo. So if we want to bring our new headache medication to market, what we have to do is we have to get a bunch of people who suffer from headaches. Say we get 1,000 people. We have to split them into two groups of 500, give one group of 500 our real drug, give the other group of 500 a fake drug with nothing inside of it, you know, put anything inside of it as long as it won't hurt the people, and then you see if the quote-unquote real drug works better than the fake drug. And what's interesting is every time the fake drug works. If you take your group of 1,000 and you split them into three, one group of 333 gets the real drug, one group of 333 gets a fake drug, and one group of 333 gets a glass of water and is told, maybe we'll give you a drug later, the group with the glass of water has a lot more headaches, and their headaches are worse. The group that gets the fake drug actually feels better. And in the cases of many drug trials, the group that gets the fake drug feels just as good as the group that gets the real drug. And sometimes the group that gets the fake drug feels even better. That's the placebo effect. The placebo effect is the very reliable, very consistent, completely dependable impact of getting someone to believe that they've had something done for them that will make them feel better, and they actually feel better. And the placebo effect has been observed with lots of things. It's actually been observed with surgery. There was a study that was done on knee surgeries to look at the effectiveness of two different knee surgeries. And what they did is they took a big study population, say 3,000 people. They put 1,000 people in a group where they got the old-fashioned knee surgery. They put 1,000 people in a group where they got the new knee surgery, and to make it a scientific study, they gave 1,000 people placebo knee surgery. They literally cut the skin open on their knee and then sewed their knee back up and told them that they'd had surgery. sure enough, the people who got placebo knee surgery, their knee health improved. Their pain diminished. They regained mobility. Even surgery worked with the placebo effect. Thinking they had surgery changed their knee function. The most astonishing thing about the placebo effect is it's not in people's heads. You can measure it biochemically. So if you give someone who has a migraine headache a drug and you say, this is morphine, and they believe you, within about an hour, you can actually measure in their bloodstream an increase in the body's own pain-relieving chemicals called endorphins, which mimic morphine. In fact, morphine is a drug that mimics these internal chemicals called endorphins. If you really get present to how astonishing this is, you give somebody nothing, a sugar pill, just something that's it just gets their attention. You say to them, this drug's going to take your headache away. And then their body produces the chemical that takes the headache away. That person doesn't even know what that chemical is. They don't have to know what an endorphin is. They don't even have to know how morphine works. But the body knows. So there's a translation from their belief, and it is belief. This works based on belief. There's a translation from their belief that they've been given something that's going to make them feel better into an actual chemical shift that makes them feel better. And a perceptual shift. They think they feel better, and they do, in fact, feel better. So their perception and their biochemistry changes based on belief. Now, you take that same person, and you say to them, you know, the mind-body connection is real, and if you just believe your headache will go away, you can make it go away. Their headache's not going to go away because they don't believe it. But if you train yourself to be able to create consciously the kinds of internal shifts that belief in a placebo creates subconsciously, you can leverage an enormous amount of power over your body and over your life. And it takes tremendous discipline and it takes training, but it works. And this is what many meditative systems are about. They're not about controlling the body, but they're about controlling the subconscious mind. This is what a lot of Zen Buddhism is about. This is what a lot of the Eastern meditation systems are about. And I know that when I was growing up, and I was in my early 20s, and I was a sciencey guy, I looked at Buddhists meditating and Hindu guys meditating, and I thought, this is ridiculous. This is another form of silliness, you know, just some sort of institutionalized silliness. But the more I opened up to it and I started to read about this stuff and look at some of the studies that had been done, it's kind of fascinating what these people could do. You know, they could raise and lower their body temperature consciously. They could dramatically slow their heart rate consciously, things that without training is virtually impossible. And sure enough, as scientists began to look at the brains of monks who'd been meditating for years, their brain scans were different. They were using different parts of their brains. And in point of fact, parts of the brains associated with relaxation could be increased by some of these people. So this science has emerged over the course of the last couple decades. On the one hand, confirming that the chemistry that is changed by thought also changes the body. Then on the other hand, confirming that people who really learn how to train their minds can really alter their brain states and even their physical states in meaningful ways. And this stuff has been written up and published, and even though many scientists and doctors would say it's crap, it's out there in the literature, and it's very well confirmed. And there are all sorts of prestigious institutions that do these studies, and they get published, and most people don't believe them, even though they're getting done at, you know, Princeton and NIH and really well-established, famous places. There's actually a book called Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain that was written about 5 years ago by a science journalist, someone who just tracks science. And she's, you know, a skeptical person, but she ultimately came to the conclusion that this stuff is really real. And that a lot of the things that the Dalai Lama and Buddhists have been saying about the power of consciousness and meditation is completely real. So we're at the point where the science of the power of mind-body interactions is unequivocal. Really, you can't argue with it anymore. It's overwhelming. It's like global warming. 4 or 5 years ago, lots of people still pretended that global warming wasn't real. And even a lot of scientists and mainstream authorities kind of were like, oh, global warming, we're not sure it's real. But anyone who actually read the science, like anyone who wasn't just kind of defending what they'd already thought for 20 years because they'd thought it for 20 years, people who were really present to the truth, they kind of knew global warming was real. And it's the same with this mind-body business. It's astonishing. There's actually a whole science of this now called noetics. and there's an Institute for Noetics. And if you read the most recent Dan Brown book, it's really worth reading. It's called The Lost Symbol. It deals with noetics, and the science in that book is real. Noetics is the science of really interesting mind-body phenomena. Like, the mind seems to have all this power that transcends what we normally thought was possible. This is scientific. It's not revolutionary. It's not out there in the ether. I like to think of this as kind of the next great revolution in science, actually. And it's interesting to put yourself back a couple centuries. And imagine you're living in the 1800s, and someone said to you, you know, you're surrounded by all sorts of mystical fields. And these mystical fields carry energy. And if we manipulated these fields right, if we manipulated this energy right, we could do things like talk to one another with little devices from halfway across the world. And we could beam images that our eyes could see through space that would then beam back down to Earth, and other people could see what you could see even though they were in another country. It would sound like magic. It would sound like insanity. And yet that turned out to just be physics, and it turned out to be the way that the external world functions. Well, we're poised on the brink of another great revolution. It's not the electronics revolution. It's not a revolution understanding electromagnetism or anything in the what we could call the external or physical world. It's a revolution in understanding the internal world and understanding the mind and its depth and its real complexity and consciousness. And these phenomena that are beginning to penetrate into science are just the tip of the iceberg. This is where the real power and the real meaning to me in health and fitness lies, because this is access to well-being. So before we talk about the practicalities of how to do this, I really want to pose this question. What's your goal in doing this, in everything you do, in life in general, and in your interactions with other human beings? We all have what I would call outer goals. Outer goals have to do with changes you can see. Changes in monetary status, changes in the way we look, changes in, you know, blood tests when we go into the doctor, changes on the scale. But then there's the inner goals, which we don't think about very much. And when, if asked, we sort of would simplistically reply, of course I want to be happy, and of course I want other people to be happy, of course I want to be at peace. Really? Do we really think about that stuff that much? Do we really invest attention and energy in it? And you know how you know the answer is no? We don't study it. If we really cared about happiness and peace, if we really cared about feeling better emotionally, wouldn't we study it directly? Wouldn't we put our energy into it? We sort of superficially give lip service to caring about that stuff, but mostly we're just concerned with the, you know, concerns of life, the normal problems. And then we have some background concept that if we solved all those problems, if we got our finances and our bodies and our relationships all perfect, we would be happy. But you don't really need to look around very much to realize that that's not actually true either, because you see people who get all that stuff right, and they're not happy either. I mean, you look at, you know, Hollywood, and you look at people who seem to have the things that the rest of us want, and they're not especially happy people, and it doesn't take a tremendous amount of reasoning to come to the conclusion that all of us are fundamentally the same. And so this issue of our goals, there's a piece missing. There's a confusion, or there's a dark spot, or there's something that we're not present to, that we're not facing, that we're not owning. And the reality of what's going on for most of us is we don't think a lot about happiness, and we don't think a lot about inner peace, and we don't think a lot about joy, precisely because those concepts are very threatening. They're very scary. It's scary to think I'm not happy. It's scary to think I don't have joy in my life. It's scary to think I don't have peace in my life. Most people don't want to face those realizations. They'd much rather think about fixing their problems and getting to some space in the future where they get stuff right. And then once we have faced it, and people who've experienced enough depression or anxiety or pain will be able to really stop and say, you know what, I'm not happy. And I don't need to hide that fact. I can share with others that I'm not happy, and I can start looking for help. I think initially the idea that nothing in your outer life changing is really going to make much of a difference is extremely threatening. Even the idea that doing things like getting in shape and eating right and taking the right supplements and all, it can make a difference, sure, because the body does affect the brain. But that fundamentally, that still surface, it's scary. And it's because we're scared of our own minds. We're scared of our psychological depth. We're scared of what we might find there. We're scared of our past. We really are scared of our past. We're scared to look at relationships. We're scared of looking at who we've been. We're scared to open up the doors that are inside of us. And if you don't know how to do this stuff, and if you're not prepared and you don't go about it the right way, good to be scared. You don't want to mess around with your mind. On the flip side, if happiness is the goal, and if peace is the goal, and if being a joyous person is the goal, and being a loving person is the goal, and a great way to think about it is, isn't that what you want for your kids if you have kids? If you don't have kids, you can imagine your children. Isn't that what you want for them? Well, of course, right? Isn't it what you want for your dearest friends and loved ones? And why isn't it what we want for ourselves? It is what we want for ourselves at the deepest level, I really believe. Everyone wants this. We have to deal with the mind. It's such a simple point, but it evades our everyday attention. I mean, our primary goals are mental states of being. The deepest goals, joy, peace, happiness, contentment, fulfillment, a sense of purpose. These are mental states of being. If we don't learn to deal with the mind and learn to control the mind to some extent and work with the nature of the mind, how on earth can we hope to get there? It's like with the body. You don't understand the body. You don't understand the food that it needs. You don't understand the movement that it needs. You don't understand the things that it needs to be kept away from, like toxins, then you're just at the mercy of circumstance, and your body's not going to work very well. And the point that I tried to drive home in the first three classes is harmony with the nature of the body, understanding how it works and living in harmony with that, that's the key to getting the body to work. Well, getting the mind to work is infinitely better than getting your body to work. Better, one, because the mind affects the body directly. Better, two, because your motivation to take actions that will affect your body comes from your mind. But really, ultimately, better because the thing that we want most in the world is a mental thing. We want to feel really good. And what we want to give to others, to contribute to others, what on earth could we want to contribute to others more than making them feel good, more than making them feel deeply well? Because when you're in that state, you can take care of everything else. And that's maybe the final point I'll say on this. When you feel really well, which involves confidence and a level of inspiration, it's easy to do. You can just do what you need to do and get things done, and quality flows into everything that you do. So this issue of getting to a positive mental emotional state is kind of everything. It's like the whole onion in one. Learning what you need to learn about nutrition, exercise, supplements, all that, it's super easy. When you're in a positive, happy emotional state, your mind's open, you're going to assimilate information, you're going to apply it, there's not going to be fear, there's not going to be procrastination, there's not going to be self-sabotage, there's not going to be the normal stuff that stops people from succeeding. Plus, even better, you'll be happy. So, this is a breakthrough results course. We got 9 sessions. We cover a lot of content. It is completely impossible to do service to how you go about doing this in the context of this course. It's impossible. And I do offer another course that gets into this. It's a 6-week course, but what we're concerned with tonight is how to start. There has been a lot of very excellent research done on the most effective ways to shape the mind, for lack of a better terminology, to sort of begin understanding, my God, I have a mind, and if I learn to work with how this mind works, I can actually take some control over what you could call the subconscious or the emotional mind or the things that seem out of your control. They're only out of our control because we don't know how they work. We don't have any access to the control. So the two best confirmed ways of working with the mind and helping yourself feel better are something called cognitive behavioral therapy and meditation. Now, cognitive behavioral therapy comes out of the Western tradition. This is from Western psychology. It's aligned with Western medicine. And it's sort of like a psychotherapeutic technique, but you can actually learn to do it for yourself. Unlike psychotherapy, you can be led through it in ways that are very easy, and it's relatively simple. The best resource that I know of for this, I know I've shared this with some of you already, but the best resource I know of for this is something called The Work on the Web. The Work, like W-O-R-K, on the Web. And what The Work on the Web is it's basically an interactive cognitive behavioral therapy modality that teaches you to examine the content of your own subconscious and shatter through belief patterns that are limiting and aren't serving you well. Another form of something similar to cognitive behavioral therapy, although it wouldn't call itself this, it bills itself as transformational work, but it's really doing the same thing. It's shattering through beliefs. That is extraordinarily effective as a course called the Landmark Forum. And I recommend this course wholeheartedly. I'm not affiliated with Landmark Education in any way. You'll never give them my name. There's no business connections here. But the Landmark Forum is an introduction to understanding the dynamics of how your mind functions that can begin to help you get control. So I recommend cognitive behavioral therapy. I recommend the Landmark Forum. I think they both have a lot to offer. I think that ultimately you have to go deeper, and meditation is the way that you go deeper. So meditation, also it's kind of a buzzword in our culture. It's kind of out there in the ether, and we've all sort of heard of it, and we all have our opinions about it. Meditation is not well understood. Most of us, I think, when we think of meditation, we either picture, you know, sitting in the lotus position, that yogic position with your feet curled up with your hands in that strange finger-touching thumb position and just breathing. Or we sort of know you're supposed to clear your mind and think of nothing. Or maybe you're supposed to just focus on your breath and, like, watch your breath and count your breath. And if you've ever tried any of this, clearing your mind and thinking of nothing, you may have experienced frustration. In fact, I invite you to do this with me right now, if you're on the phone or if you're listening over MP3, take 10 seconds, if there's a clock around you, take 10 seconds and clear your mind. Literally don't think when I say go. And when I say don't think, I mean no images, no incessant stream of internal mental chatter, no language, no voice spinning through your head. If you're saying, I don't have a voice spinning through your head, that's the voice in your head right now that's saying, I don't have a voice in my head, what's he talking about, I don't, you know, believe in any of it. That's the voice. Clear your mind, literally. See if you have voluntary control. Can you turn your mind off and hold it in a blank space? So we're going to do this for 10 seconds, and we're going to start when I say go. Okay, go. Okay, that's about 10 seconds. And if you're like most people, that was either a real struggle or you found that to be completely impossible. Well, trying to start meditating by holding your mind blank, very, very challenging. I don't actually think it's a good way to go in the beginning. It can be frustrating. You can experience a lot of anxiety. But then also, what's the point? Why? Why learn to hold your mind blank? And that's really a big thing that's missing from many meditation systems. What's the point? Well, we could have an intense, wonderful discussion about the point of meditation. But really, I would say the point of meditation is to feel better. The point of meditation is to feel relaxed and more peaceful now, to put yourself consciously choose to and then succeed in making yourself feel more relaxed and feel better right now, and to build the capacity to feel better and more relaxed anytime. And meditation is sort of a form of mind training. It's like the ability to gain conscious relaxation, to understand how to relax consciously. Imagine how useful this would be, to be able to consciously, truly make a decision and chill out, feel more at peace, more at rest, stop your mind from racing, reduce stress, literally at will. This is not unrealistic. This is not an impossible goal. This is like being able to feel relaxed and at peace at will has about the same level of challenge, I would say, as maintaining about a 5.5-minute mile pace for 5 miles. Now, that's not easy. You got to train to do that. I couldn't walk out of my apartment right now and do that. But with persistence and diligence and training and understanding how to train, how my body works, what I have to do, and believing that the goal is worthwhile, I could get there. And you could get there too, probably. And, of course, depending on age. But the great thing with meditation is anyone can get there, even people who can't run 5.5-minute miles, over 5 miles. So a realistic goal with meditation is over a period of years of teaching yourself to be able to learn to consciously relax. But, and this is more exciting because we don't like to think about years, within weeks to notice a difference when you do it, to feel more relaxed. And if you can commit to and combine a cognitive behavioral therapy practice, or if you can do a course like the Landmark Forum, or educate yourself more about any of this stuff, and also commit to a meditation program, you'll begin a process of taking your own mental function and therefore your emotions out of the involuntary machinery that drives it now. And I really do mean involuntary machinery. The way you know is you can't control it. Right now, don't think. Or next time someone is aggressive towards you, don't get angry. Doesn't help anything. Next time you're in traffic, don't get annoyed. What could be more useless than being annoyed in traffic? Completely destructive, doesn't create anything. And yet we seem to be out of control in these situations. You really truly can get to a point where in those situations you can bring yourself to a deeper state of peace. The real significance of this is awesome. It does make a profound and lasting difference in happiness. It allows you to move in the direction of the outer goals that you do set with far more ease. And it just really shifts your perspective on life. And that was what I started off this course talking about, was perspective. When you commit to meditation, when you commit to these other modalities that kind of work with meditation, like cognitive behavioral therapy, you start to think differently about why you do what you do. Your perspective changes. It's like the difference between building a park so kids could play and building a park to build community and help kids build self-esteem. Now you're going to the gym, and to some extent, you know, you go to the gym because you're going to get your abs looking right or you're going to lose some weight or whatever. But it's not that significant to you. There's no stress in it. There's no drama. You're not unhappy and waiting to get there to be happy. You're not worried about people criticizing you because your deeper goal is to be at peace. It's to enjoy the process. It's to enjoy your life. And this isn't some abstract, you know, weird Buddhist meditative thing. It's just the simple reality of feeling positive emotion now and letting that positive emotion fuel you through life. And you begin to find that you just don't stress life so much anymore. All of your goals get recontextualized, your financial goals, where you want to get in the world, all that stuff. It's not that it's not important anymore, and it's certainly not that you become apathetic. I mean, again, I teach nutrition and fitness classes. I like people to stick to their diets and to do exercise programs because you'll live longer and you'll feel better, and all that stuff can be important. But it begins to lose that element of, I have to get this right. I won't feel right until I get this right. And I look at all of this with a sense of restriction. And I sort of think, I need more discipline. I need to force myself to do this stuff. I need to be more in control. I need to oppose my will against those bad impulses inside me that make me want to do things that I don't want to do or stop me from doing the things that I want to do. It's just not a struggle anymore. And then there's also not the sense of, I don't like my body the way that it is. I don't feel good about myself. I need to change this in order to feel better. There's a simpler relationship with emotion. Emotion is appreciated in a new way. You start to get, one, it's emotion that changes your body. When you're feeling good, your body's doing good. Emotion is everything. You also start to understand that emotion, while it is chemistry, that really fundamentally emotion is created by thought as long as you're healthy. In an unhealthy body, you don't have enough of the right nutrition, you can't feel good. But in a healthy body, emotion is created by thought, because you can make all the right chemistry if your body's healthy. So that the way that you feel is really a consequence of how you think, not a consequence of your external life. It's a big transition. It's not about how things are going in business. It's really not even about how things are appearing in relationships. It's about your state of being. It's about your state of being is about your thinking. So as you meditate more and more, you start to grasp that connection, not as an intellectual concept, because you actually feel more peace. You feel more joy. And you're able, when you start to get stressed, to stop it, to nip it in the bud and make yourself feel better. And then when you're in that space, life becomes far simpler. And what I hope from this discussion tonight, because this is the only class we're going to do on this mind-body stuff, I know it's not what a lot of people were looking for when they signed up for this. I know it sounds a little out there to some of you. What I hope from tonight is really, really only twofold. One, I would like you to try a practice, to try some sort of practice that will actually begin to bring some of this mind-body stuff into your life. If you are extremely cynical, try breathing practice. Change the way you breathe. I'm going to send out a tutorial that explains functional and dysfunctional breathing. I emailed it out last week. I'm going to send it out again. Take this on as your mind-body practice, because learning to breathe properly is a mind-body practice. If you are medium cynical, medium skeptical, go take the Landmark Forum. It's like $400. It's worth it. I promise you it's worth it. It'll change your life. And I'm pretty sure they'll give you your money back if you tell them it was crap. But no one does. People love that course. It's tremendous. Great, great course. If you're a little skeptical, go do the work on the web. If you're open-minded, start meditating. And meditation, it is such a gift to give yourself. To help you start meditating, I'm going to post an audio meditation on the course website that you can download. It's a lead meditation. It's 17 and a half minutes long. You can download it and just listen to it. I'm leading it. And you just tune out and do what the meditation says. It's a very simple form of meditation called inner body meditation or body awareness meditation. It's the best place to start. And the whole goal is just to help you relax and chill out right now. And if you try the meditation and you like it, you take it on, do it 3 times a week for the next couple of weeks, and you dig it, do yourself a favor, drop me a line, talk to me about this stuff further. I'll give you some reading resources. We can talk about the next time I'm going to offer a class on this. But it's just awesome. And so the perspective that you're taking away now is that my life, my goals, are more about the way I feel than about getting to some external end. And if you can put that concept at the center of what we're up to in this class, it'll begin to change everything. Then, yes, you'll get knowledge from this, and if you apply this knowledge and you take action, you'll get results. But the action and the results will become secondary. What you'll really be all about is, how am I bringing my whole life into harmony with the emotional state of being that I want to live my life in, knowing that that emotional state of being is going to change my body directly, give me the motivation to take the actions that I want, and most importantly, it's what I really want anyway. I want to be at peace. I want to be happy. So this is the end of the beginning of this course, the end of the beginning. We started out this course talking about living in harmony with nature, and the way you do that is to remember your meds, mind state, exercise, diet, sleep. I said we were going to take mind state, shove it to the side, talk about exercise, diet, and sleep, and we've done that. We've talked about those physiological variables. Tonight we talked about mind state, and we attempted to sort of integrate it into this total picture in a way that's scientific and rational and practical. So now you got it all. You want to be a happy, healthy person. The formula is truly pretty much this simple from my perspective. You eat the way your body is designed to eat. You move the way your body is designed to move. You sleep and regulate your lifestyle in harmony with the way that your body is designed. And then the last one, the big one, the M, is actually far bigger than that. You learn to think and feel in harmony with the way that our minds are really capable and ultimately, I would argue, designed to work. That design is not an evolution thing. It's not a survival thing. It's a deeper thing. It's a consciousness thing. But it is still a harmony. It's still an understanding the nature of the mind and learning to live in harmony with it. And if you can think right, eat right, move right, sleep right, you're probably going to thrive and succeed at everything you do. You can't eat right, move right, or sleep right if you don't think right. Your mind gets in the way. And if your mind is out of harmony, if you're feeling lots of stress and negative emotion, it's going to undermine the positive impacts of diet and exercise and all that great stuff. So, like I said, we're at the end of the beginning. We kind of got all the pieces in place. Take this meditation. Hopefully you can apply it. And if this interests you, if you want to go deeper, please get in touch. That's my content for tonight. I am happy to take questions. Any questions?
No, I don't think so.
Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Yeah?
Yep.
It's great food for thought, all of this is. Great food for thought. And I know most of you guys are on MP3, so if you have any questions about this, please email me. It's a real revolution. I mean, it's a different way to think. But my hope is that I approach this from a science-y enough place that for those of you who are a little more skeptical, we made the connection in a way that seems plausible to you. And I've recommended lots of resources to different people with different beliefs over the years. So whether you are Christian or you're Buddhist or Jewish or an atheist or agnostic or a skeptical, I probably can find some stuff that you can consume that, if some of this appealed to you, will speak in a language that you can hear. So let me call it a wrap with that, and I will look forward to talking to you guys next week. And then I'm out of town, and we have a day off on the schedule on, I believe it's the 17th, whatever that Wednesday is, and then we'll be back after that, okay?
Okay.
Okay, good night. All the best.
Good night.